And now, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Chapter 17, by Mark Twain. In about a minute, somebody spoke out of a window without putting his head out, and says,
"Be done, boys. Who's there?"
I says, "It's me."
"Who's me?"
"George Jackson, sir."
"What do you want?"
"I don't want nothing, sir. I only want to go along by, but the dogs won't let me."
"What are you prowling around here this time of night for, eh?"
"I weren't prowling around, sir. I fell overboard off the steamboat."
"Oh, you did you? Strike a light there, somebody. What did you say your name was?"
"George Jackson, sir. I'm only a boy."
"Look here. If you're telling the truth, you needn't be afraid. Nobody'll hurt you. But don't try to budge. Stand right where you are. Rouse out, Bob and Tom, some of you, and fetch the guns. George Jackson, is there anybody with you?"
"No, sir, nobody." I heard the people stirring around in the house now, and I seen a light. The man sung out,
"Snatch that light away, Betsy, you old fool. Ain't you got any sense? Put it on the floor behind the front door. Bob, if you and Tom are ready, take your places. Now, George Jackson, do you know the Shepherdsons?"
"No, sir, I never heard of 'em."
"Well, that may be so, and it mayn't. Now, all ready. Step forward, George Jackson, and mind, don't you hurry. Come mighty slow. If there's anybody with you, let him keep back. And if he shows himself, he'll be shot. Come along now. Come slow. Push the door open yourself. Just enough to squeeze in. You hear?"
I didn't hurry. I couldn't if I'd have wanted to. I took one slow step at a time, and there weren't a sound. Only I thought I could hear my heart. The dogs were still as the humans, but they followed a little behind me. When I got to the 3 log doorsteps, I heard them unlocking and unbarring and unbolting. I put my hand on the door and pushed it a little and a little more till somebody said,
"There, that's enough. Put your head in."
I done it, but I judged they would take it off. The candle was on the floor, and there they all was, looking at me, and me at them, for about a quarter of a minute. 3 big men with guns pointed at me, which made me wince, I'll tell you. The oldest, gray and about 60, the other 2, 30 or more, all of them fine and handsome, and the sweetest old gray-headed lady, and back of her 2 young women, which I couldn't see right well. The old gentleman says,
"There, I reckon it's all right. Come in."
As soon as I was in, the old gentleman, he locked the door, and barred it, and bolted it, and told the young men to come in with their guns, and they all went in a big parlor that had a new rag carpet on the floor, and got together in a corner that was out of the range of the front windows. There weren't none on the side. They held the candle, and took a good look at me, and they all said, "Why, he ain't a Shepherdson. No, there ain't any Shepherdson about him." Then the old man said he hoped I wouldn't mind being searched for arms, because he didn't mean no harm by it. It was only to make sure. So he didn't pry into my pockets, but only felt outside with his hands and said it was all right. He told me to make myself easy and at home, and tell all about myself. But the old lady says, "Why, bless you, Saul, the poor thing's as wet as he can be, and don't you reckon it may be he's hungry?"
"True for you, Rachel, I forgot."
So the old lady says, "Betsy," that was her help, "you fly around and get him something to eat as quick as you can, poor thing, and one of you girls go and wake up Buck and tell him, oh, here he is himself. Buck, take this little stranger and get the wet clothes off from him and dress him up in some of yours that's dry." Buck looked about as old as me, 13 or 14 or along there, though he was a little bigger than me. He hadn't on anything but a shirt, and he was very frowsy-headed. He came in yawning and digging one fist into his eyes, and he was dragging a gun along with the other one. He says, "Ain't they no Shepherdsons around?" They said, "No, 'twas a false alarm." "Well," he says, "if they'd have been some, I'd have reckoned I'd have got one." They all laughed, and Bob says, "Why, Buck, they might have scalped us all. You've been so slow in coming." "Well, nobody come after me, and it ain't right I'm always kept down. I don't get no show."
"Never mind, Buck, my boy," says the old man. "You'll have show enough, all in good time. Don't you fret about that. Go along with you now, and do as your mother told you."
When we got upstairs to his room, he got me a coarse shirt and a roundabout and pants of his, and I put them on. While I was at it, he asked me what my name was, but before I could tell him, he started to tell me about a blue jay and a young rabbit he'd catched in the woods the day before yesterday. And he asked me where Moses was when the candle went out. I said I didn't know. I hadn't heard about it before, no way.
"Well, guess," he says.
"How am I going to guess," says I, "when I never heard tell of it before?"
"But you can guess, can't you? It's just as easy."
"Which candle?" I says.
"Why, any candle,"
he says.
"I don't know where he was," says I.
"Where was he?"
"Why, he was in the dark. That's where he was."
"Well, if you'd have known where he was, what'd you ask me for?"
"Why, blame it, it's a riddle, don't you see? Say, how long are you going to stay here? You got to stay, always. We can just have booming times. They don't have no school now.
Do you own a dog?"
"I got a dog, and he'll go in the river, bring out chips that you throw in. Do you like to comb up Sundays and all that kind of foolishness?"
"You bet I don't. But Ma, she makes me.
Confound these old britches. I reckon I better put 'em on, but I'd rather not. It's so warm.
Are you all ready?"
"All right. Come along, old hoss."
Cold corn pone, cold corn beef, butter, and buttermilk. That is what they had for me down there, and there ain't nothing better that I've ever come across yet. Buck and his Ma and all of them smoked cob pipes, except the help, who was gone, and the two young women. They all smoked and talked, and I ate and talked. The young women had quilts around them and their hair down their backs. They all asked me questions, and I told them how Pap and me and all the family was living on a little farm down at the bottom of Arkansas, and my sister Mary Ann run off and got married and never was heard of no more, and Bill went to hunt them, and he weren't heard of no more, and Tom and Mort died, and then there weren't nobody but just me and Pap left, and he was just trimmed down to nothing on account of all his troubles. So when he died, I took what there was left, because the farm didn't belong to us, and started up river, deck passage, and fell overboard. And that was how I come to be here. So they said I could have a home there as long as I wanted it. Then it was most daylight, and everybody went to bed, and I went to bed with Buck, and when I waked up in the morning, drat it all, I forgot what my name was. So I laid there about an hour trying to think, and when Buck waked up, I says, "Can you spell, Buck?"
"Yeah," he says.
"I bet you can't spell my name," says I.
"I'll bet you what you dare I can," says he.
"All right," says I. "Go ahead."
G-E-O-R-G-E-J-A-X-O-N. "There now," he says.
"Well," says I, "you done it. But I didn't think you could. It ain't no slouch of a name to spell, right off, without studying." I set it down, private, because somebody might want me to spell it next, so I wanted to be handy with it and rattle it off like I was used to it. It was a mighty nice family, and a mighty nice house, too. I hadn't seen no house out in the country before that was so nice and had so much style. It didn't have an iron latch on the front door, nor a wooden one with a buckskin string, but a brass knob to turn, the same as houses in town. There weren't no bed in the parlor, nor a sign of a bed, but heaps of parlors in town had beds in them. There was a big fireplace that was bricked on the bottom, and the bricks was kept clean and red by pouring water on them and scrubbing them with another brick. Sometimes they washed them over with red water paint that they call Spanish brown, same as they do in town. They had big brass dog irons that could hold up a saw log. There was a clock on the middle of the mantelpiece
with a picture of a town painted on the bottom half of the glass front, and a round place in the middle of it for the sun, and you could see the pendulum swinging behind it. It was beautiful to hear that clock tick, and sometimes, when one of those peddlers had been along and scoured her up and got her in good shape, she would start in and strike 150 before she got tuckered out. They wouldn't have took any money for her. Well, there was a big outlandish parrot on each side of the clock, made out of something like chalk, and painted up gaudy. By one of the parrots was a cat made of crockery, and a crockery dog by the other, and when you pressed down on them, they squeaked, but didn't open their mouths, nor look different, nor interested. They squeaked through underneath. There was a couple of big wild turkey-wing fans spread out behind those things. On the table in the middle of the room was a kind of lovely crockery basket that had apples and oranges and peaches and grapes piled up in it, which was much redder and yellower and prettier than real ones is. But they weren't real, because you could see where pieces had been chipped off and showed the white chalk, or whatever it was, underneath. This table had a cover made out of beautiful oilcloth with a red and blue spread eagle painted on it, and a painted border all around. It come all the way from Philadelphia, they said. There were some books, too, piled up perfectly exact on each corner of the table. One was a big family Bible full of pictures. One was Pilgrim's Progress, about a man that left his family, but it didn't say why. I read considerable in it now and then. The statements was interesting, but tough. Another was Friendship's Offering, full of beautiful stuff and poetry, but I didn't read the poetry. Another was Henry Clay's Speeches, and another was Dr. Gunn's Family Medicine, which told you all about what to do if a body was sick or dead. There was a hymn book, and a lot of other books, and there was nice split-bottom chairs, and perfectly sound, too, not bagged down in the middle and busted like an old basket. They had pictures hung on the walls, mainly Washington's and Lafayette's and battles and Highland Mary's and one called Signing the Declaration. There was some that they called crayons, which one of the daughters, which was dead, made her own self when she was only 15 years old. They was different from any pictures I ever seen before, blacker mostly than is common. One was a woman in a slim black dress, belted small under the armpits, with bulges like a cabbage in the middle of the sleeves, and a large black scoop shovel bonnet with a black veil, and white slim ankles crossed about with black tape, and very wee black slippers, like a chisel. And she was leaning pensive on a tombstone on her right elbow under a weeping willow, and her other hand hanging down her side, holding a white handkerchief and a reticule. And underneath the picture it said, "Shall I never see thee more, alas?" Another one was a young lady with her hair all combed up straight to the top of her head and knotted there in front of a comb like a chair back, and she was crying into a handkerchief and had a dead bird laying on its back in her other hand with its heels up, and underneath the picture it said, "I shall never hear thy sweet chirrup more, alas." There was one where a young lady was at a window looking up at the moon and tears running down her cheeks, and she had an open letter in one hand with black sealing wax showing on one edge of it, and she was mashing a locket with a chain to it against her mouth, and underneath the picture it said, "And art thou gone? Yes, thou art gone, alas." They was all nice pictures, I reckon, but I didn't somehow seem to take to them, because if ever I was down a little, they always give me the fantods. Everybody was sorry she died, because she had laid out a lot more of these pictures to do, and a body could see, by what she had done, what they had lost. But I reckon that with her disposition, she was having a better time in the graveyard. She was at work on what they said was her greatest picture when she took sick, and every day and every night it was her prayer to be allowed to live till she got it done. But she never got the chance. It was a picture of a young woman in a long white gown, standing on the rail of a bridge all ready to jump off, with her hair all down her back, and looking up to the moon, with the tears running down her face, and she had two arms folded across her breast, and two arms stretched out in front, and two more reaching up towards the moon. And the idea was to see which pair would look best, and then scratch out all the other arms. But as I was saying, she died before she got her mind made up. And now they kept this picture over the head of the bed in her room, and every time her birthday come,
they hung flowers on it. Other times it was hid with a little curtain. The young woman in the picture had a kind of a nice, sweet face, but there were so many arms, it made her look too spidery, seemed to me. This young girl kept a scrapbook when she was alive, and used to paste obituaries and accidents and cases of patient suffering in and out of the Presbyterian Observer, and write poetry after them out of her own head. It was very good poetry. This is what she wrote about a boy by the name of Stephen Dowling Botts that fell down a well and was drowned. Ode to Stephen Dowling Botts. And did young Stephen sicken? And did young Stephen die? And did the sad hearts thicken? And did the mourners cry? No, such was not the fate of young Stephen Dowling Botts. Those sad hearts round him thicken, 'twas not from sickness shots. No whooping cough did rack his frame, nor measles drear with spots. Not those impaired with sacred name of Stephen Dowling Botts. Despised love struck not with woe that head of curly knots, nor stomach troubles laid him low, young Stephen Dowling Botts. Oh, no. Then list with tearful eye, whilst I his fate do tell. His soul did from this cold world fly by falling down a well. They got him out and emptied him. Alas, it was too late. His spirit was gone for to sport aloft in the realms of good and great. If Emmeline Grangerford could make poetry like that before she was 14, there ain't no telling what she could have done by and by. Buck said she could rattle off poetry like nothing. She didn't ever have to stop to think. He said she would slap down a line, and if she couldn't find anything to rhyme with it, she'd just scratch it out and slap down another one and go ahead. She weren't particular. She could write about anything you choose to give her to write about, just so it was sadful.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Every time a man died or a woman died or a child died, she'd be on hand with her tribute before he was cold. She called them tributes. The neighbors said it was the doctor first, then Emmeline, then the undertaker. The undertaker never got in ahead of Emmeline but once, and then she hung fire on a rhyme for the dead person's name, which was Whistler. She weren't ever the same after that. She never complained, but she kind of pined away and didn't live long. Poor thing, many's the time I've made myself go up to that little room that used to be hers and get out her poor old scrapbook and read in it when her pictures had been aggravating me, and I'd soured on her a little. I liked all of that family, dead ones and all, and weren't going to let anything come between us. Poor Emmeline made poetry about all the dead people when she was alive. It didn't seem right that there weren't nobody to make some about her now, and she was gone. So I tried to sweat out a verse or two myself, but I couldn't seem to make it go somehow. They kept Emmeline's room trim and nice, and all the things fixed in it just the way she'd like to have them when she was alive, and nobody ever slept there. The old lady took care of the room herself, though they had plenty of help. And she sewed there a good deal, and read her Bible there mostly. Well, as I was saying about the parlor, there was beautiful curtains on the windows, white, with pictures painted on them with castles and vines all down the walls, and cattle coming down to drink. There was a little old piano, too, that had tin pans in it, I reckon, and nothing was ever so lovely as to hear the young ladies sing, "The Last Link is Broken." The walls of all the rooms was plastered, and most had carpets on the floors, and the whole house was whitewashed on the outside. It was a double house, and the big open place betwixt them was roofed and floored, and sometimes the table was set there in the middle of the day, and it was a cool, comfortable place. Nothing couldn't be better. And weren't the cooking good, and just bushels of it, too. Chapter 18. Colonel Grangerford was a gentleman, you see. He was a gentleman all over, and so was his family. He was well-born, as the saying is, and that's worth as much in a man as it is in a horse. So the Widow Douglas said, and nobody ever denied that she was of the first aristocracy in our town. And Pap, he always said it too, although he weren't no more quality than a mudcat himself. Colonel Grangerford was very tall and very slim, and had a darkish, paly complexion, not a sign of red in it anywheres. He was clean-shaved every morning all over his thin face, and he had the thinnest kind of lips, and the thinnest kind of nostrils, and a high nose, and heavy eyebrows, and the blackest kind of eyes, sunk so deep back that they seemed like they was looking out of caverns at you, as you might say. His forehead was high, and his hair was black and straight, and hung to his shoulders. His hands was long and thin, and every day of his life he put on a clean shirt and a full suit from head to foot, made out of linen, so white it hurt your eyes to look at it. And on Sundays he wore a blue tail coat with brass buttons on it. He carried a mahogany cane with a silver head on it. There weren't no frivolousness about him, not a bit, and he weren't ever loud. He was as kind as he could be. You could feel that, you know, and so you had confidence. Sometimes he smiled, and it was good to see, but when he straightened himself up like a liberty pole, and the lightning begun to flicker out from under his eyebrows, you wanted to climb a tree first, and find out what the matter was afterwards. He didn't ever have to tell anybody to mind their manners. Everybody was always good-mannered where he was. Everybody loved to have him around, too. He was sunshine most always. I mean, he made it seem like good weather. When he turned into a cloud bank, it was awful dark for half a minute, and that was enough. There wouldn't nothing go wrong again for a week. When him and the old lady come down in the morning, all the family got up out of their chairs and give them good day, and didn't sit down again till they had sat down. Then Tom and Bob went to the sideboard where the decanter was and mixed a glass of bitters and handed it to him, and he held out in his hand and waited till Tom's and Bob's was mixed, and then they bowed and said, "Our duty to you, sir and madam." And they bowed the least but in the world and said thank you. And so they drank, all three, and Bob and Tom poured a spoonful of water on the sugar and a mite of whiskey or apple brandy in the bottom of their tumblers, and give it to me and Buck. Bob was the oldest, and Tom next, tall, handsome men with very broad shoulders and brown faces, and long black hair and black eyes. They dressed in white linen from head to foot, like the old gentleman, and wore broad Panama hats. Then there was Miss Charlotte. She was 25, and tall and proud and grand, but as good as she could be when she weren't stirred up. But when she was, she had a look that would make you wilt in your tracks, like her father. Miss Charlotte was beautiful. So was her sister, Miss Sophia, but it was a different kind. She was gentle and sweet like a dove, and she was only 20. Each person had their own servant to wait on them. Buck, too. My servant had a monstrous easy time, but I weren't used to having anybody do anything for me. But Buck's was on the jump most of the time. This was all there was of the family now, but there used to be more. Three sons. They got killed, and Emmeline that died. The old gentleman owned a lot of farms and over 100 slaves. Sometimes a stack of people would come there, horseback, from 10 or 15 mile around, and stay 5 or 6 days, and have such junketings round about and on the river, and dances and picnics on the woods, daytimes, and balls at the house, nights. These people were mostly kinfolks of the family. The men brought their guns with them. It was a handsome lot of quality, I tell you. There was another clan of aristocracy around there, 5 or 6 families, mostly of the name of Shepherdson. They was as high-toned and well-born and rich and grand as the tribe of Grangerfords. The Shepherdsons and Grangerfords used the same steamboat landing, which was about 2 miles above our house. So sometimes when I went up there with a lot of our folks, I used to see a lot of Shepherdsons there on their fine horses. One day Buck and me was away out in the woods hunting and heard a horse coming. We was crossing the road, and Buck says, "Quick, jump for the woods." We done it, then peeped down the woods through the leaves. Pretty soon a splendid young man came galloping down the road, setting his horse easy and looking like a soldier. He had his gun across his pommel. I had seen him before. It was young Harney Shepperton. I heard Buck's gun go off in my ear, and Harney's hat tumbled off from his head. He grabbed his gun and rode straight to the place where we was hid. But we didn't wait. We started to the woods on a run. The woods weren't thick, so I looked over my shoulder to dodge the bullet, and twice I seen Harney cover Buck with his gun. And then he rode away the way he come, to get his hat, I reckon, but I couldn't see. We never stopped running till we got home. The old gentleman's eyes blazed a minute. 'Twas pleasure, mainly, I judged. Then his face sort of smoothed down, and he says, kind of gentle, "I don't like that shooting from behind a bush. Why don't you step into the road, my boy?" "The Shepherdsons don't, Father. They always take advantage." Miss Charlotte, she held her head up like a queen while Buck was telling his tale, and her nostrils spread and her eyes snapped. The two young men looked dark, but never said nothing. Miss Sophia, she turned pale, but the color come back when she found the man wasn't hurt. Soon as I could get Buck down by the corn cribs under the trees by ourselves, I says, "Did you want to kill him, Buck?" "Yeah, you bet I did." "What'd he ever do to you?" "Him? He never done nothing to me." "Well, then, what'd you want to kill him for?" "Why, nothing. Only it's on account of the feud." "What's a feud?" "Why, where was you raised? Don't you know what a feud is?" "Never heard of it before. Tell me about it." "Well," says Buck, "a feud is this way. A man has a quarrel with another man and kills him, and then that other man's brother kills him. Then the other brothers, on both sides, goes for one another. And then the cousins chip in. And by and by, everybody's killed off, and there ain't no more feud. But it's kind of slow. It takes a long time." "Has this one been going on long, Buck?" "Well, I should reckon. It started 30 years ago, or summers along there. There was trouble about something, and then a lawsuit to settle it. And the suit went agin one of the men. So he up and shot the man that won the suit, which he would naturally do, of course, anybody would." "What was the trouble about, Buck? Land?" "I reckon, maybe. I don't know." "Well, who done the shooting? Was it a Grangerford or a Shepherdson?" "Laws, how do I know? It was so long ago." "Don't anybody know?" "Oh, yes, Pa knows, I reckon, and some of the other old people. But they don't know now what the row was about in the first place." "Has there been many killed, Buck?" "Yeah, right smart chance of funerals. But they don't always kill. Pa got a few buckshot in him, but he don't mind it, 'cause he don't weigh much anyway. Bob's been carved up some with a buoy, and Tom's been hurt once or twice." "Has anybody been killed this year, Buck?" "Yeah, we got one, and they got one. About 3 months ago, my cousin Bud, 14 years old, was riding through the woods on t'other side of the river, and he didn't have no weapon with him, which was blame foolishness. And then a lonesome place, he hears a horse a-coming behind him, and he sees old Baldy Shepherdson a-linking after him with his gun in his hand, and his white hair a-flying in the wind. Instead of jumping off and taking to the brush, Bud lowed that he could outrun him. So they had it up, nip and tuck, for 5 miles or more, the old man a-gaining all the time. So at last Bud seen it weren't any use. So he stopped, faced around so as to have the bullet holes in front, you know. And the old man, he rode up and shot him down. But he didn't get much chance to enjoy his luck, for inside of a week, our folks laid him out." "I reckon that old man was a coward, Buck." "I reckon he weren't a coward, not by a blame sight. There ain't a coward amongst them Shepherdsons, not a one. And there ain't no cowards amongst the Grangerfords, either. Why, that old man kept up his end in a fight one day for 30 minutes against 3 Grangerfords, and came out a winner. They was all a horseback. He lit off his horse and got behind a little woodpile and kept his horse before him to stop the bullets. But the Grangerfords stayed on their horses and capered around the old man and peppered away at him. And he peppered away at them. Him and his horse both went home pretty leaky and crippled, but the Grangerfords had to be fetched home, and one of them was dead, and another died the next day. No, sir, if a body's out hunting for cowards, he don't want to fool away any time amongst them Shepherdsons,
because they don't breed any of that kind. Next Sunday we all went to church, about 3 mile, everybody a horseback. The men took their guns along, and so did Buck, and kept them between their knees or stood them handy against the wall. The Shepherdsons done the same. It was pretty ornery preaching, all about brotherly love and such like tiresomeness, but everybody said it was a good sermon, and they all talked it over going home, and had such a powerful lot to say about faith and good works and free grace and pre-foreordestination, and I don't know what all, that it did seem to me to be one of the roughest Sundays I'd run across yet. About an hour after dinner, everybody was dozing around, some in their chairs and some in their rooms, and it got to be pretty dull. Buck and a dog was stretched out on the grass in that sun sound asleep. I went up to our room and judged I'd take a nap myself. I found that sweet Miss Sophia standing in her door, which was next to ours, and she took me in her room and shut the door very soft and asked me if I liked her. And I said I did. And she asked me if I would do something for her and not tell anybody. And I said I would. Then she said she'd forgot her testament and left it in the seat of church between two other books. And would I slip out quiet and go there and fetch it to her and not say nothing to nobody? I said I would. So I slid out and slipped off up the road, and there weren't anybody at the church, except maybe a hog or two, for there weren't any lock on the door, and hogs like a punchin' floor in summertime because it's cool. If you notice, most folks don't go to church only when they've got to, but a hog is different. Says I to myself, something's up. It ain't natural for a girl to be in such a sweat about a testament. So I give it a shake, and out drops a little piece of paper with 2:30 wrote on it with a pencil. I ransacked it, but couldn't find anything else. I couldn't make anything out of that, so I put the paper in the book again, and when I got home and upstairs, there was Miss Sophia in her door waiting for me.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
She pulled me in and shut the door. Then she looked in the testament till she found the paper. And as soon as she read it, she looked glad. And before a body could think, she grabbed me and gave me a squeeze and said I was the best boy in the world and not to tell anybody. She was mighty red in the face for a minute, and her eyes lighted up, and it made her powerful pretty. I was a good deal astonished, but when I got my breath, I asked her what the paper was about, and she asked me if I'd read it, and I said no, and she asked me if I could read writing, and I told her, no, only coarse hand. Then she said the paper weren't anything but a bookmark to keep her place, and I might go and play now. I went off down to the river, studying over this thing, and pretty soon I noticed that my servant was following along behind. When he was out of sight of the house, he looked back and around a second, then comes a running and says, "Marse George, if you'll come down into the swamp, I'll show you a whole stack of water moccasins." Thinks I, that's mighty curious. He said that yesterday. He ought to know a body don't love water moccasins enough to go around hunting for them. What's he up to anyway? So I says, all right, trot ahead. I followed 1/2 mile, then he struck out over the swamp and waded ankle deep as much as 1/2 mile. We come to a little flat piece of land which was dry and very thick with trees and bushes and vines, and he says, "You shove right in there just a few steps, Mars George. That's what they is. I seed 'em before. I don't care to see 'em no more." Then he slopped right along and went away, and pretty soon the trees hit him. I poked into the place a ways and come to a little open patch as big as a bedroom all hung around with vines, and found a man laying there asleep. And by jings, it was my old Jim. I waked him up, and I reckoned it was going to be a grand surprise to him to see me again. But it weren't. He nearly cried, he was so glad. but he weren't surprised. Said he'd swum along behind me that night and heard me yell every time, but dassn't answer, because he didn't want nobody to pick him up and take him into slavery again. Says he, "I gotst hurt a little, and I couldn't swim fast, so I was a considerable ways behind you towards the last. When you landed, I reckon I could catch up with you on the land, without having to shout at you. When I see that house, I begun to go slow. I was off too fur to hear what they say to you. I was afraid of the dogs. But when it was all quiet again, I knowed you was in the house, so I struck out for the woods to wait for day. Early in the morning, some of their workers come along, go on to the fields, and they tucked me and showed me this place, while the dogs can't track me on account of the water, and they brings me truck to eat every night, and tells me how you's a getting along. Why didn't you tell my Jack to fetch me here sooner, Jim? Well, 'twarn't no use to disturb you, Huck, till we could do something. But we's all right now. I've been a-buying pots and pans and victuals, as I got a chance, and a-patching up the raft nights when—" "What raft, Jim?" "Our old raft. You mean to say our old raft wasn't smashed all the finders?" "Nah, she weren't. She was tore up a good deal. One end of her was, but they weren't no great harm done. Only your traps was most all lost. If we hadn't dived so deep and swung so far under water, and the night hadn't been so dark, and we weren't so scared, and been such pumpkin heads, as the saying is, we'd have seen the raft. But it's just as well we didn't, 'cause now she's all fixed up again most as good as new, and we's got a new lot of stuff in the place of what we lost." "Well, how did you get a hold of the raft again, Jim? Did you catch her?" "How am I going to catch her when I out in the woods? No, some of their workers found her kitched on a snag along here in the bend, and they hid her in a crick amongst the willows. And they was so much a-jawing about which of 'em she belonged to most that I come to hear about it pretty soon. So I ups and settles the trouble by telling them she don't belong to none of 'em, but to you and me. And I asked them if they're going to grab a young white gentleman's property and get a hiding for it. Then I give them 10 cents apiece, and they was mighty well satisfied, and wish some old rafts had come along to make 'em rich again. They's mighty good, these people is, and whatever I wants 'em to do for me, I don't have to ask 'em twice, honey. That Jack's a good man, and pretty smart." "Yes, he is. He ain't ever told me you was here. Told me to come, and he'd show me a lot of water moccasins. If anything happens, he ain't mixed up in it. He can say he never seen us together, and it'll be the truth." I don't want to talk much about the next day. I reckon I'll cut it pretty short. I waked up about dawn, and I was going to turn over and go to sleep again when I noticed how still it was. Didn't seem to be anybody stirring. That weren't usual. Next, I noticed that Buck was up and gone. Well, I gets up a-wondering and goes downstairs. Nobody around. Everything is still as a mouse. Just the same outside. Thinks I, "What's all this mean?" Down by the woodpile, I comes across my Jack and says, "What's it all about?" Says he, "Don't you know, Marse George?" "No," says I don't." "Well, then, Miss Sophia's run off. 'Deed she has. She run off in the night sometime. Nobody don't know just when. Run off to get married to that young Harney Shepherdson, you know. Leastways, so they spec. The family found it out about 30 minutes ago, maybe a little more. And I tell you, they weren't no time to lose. Sich another hurrying up guns and hosses you never seed. The women folks is gone for to stir up the relations, and old Marse Saul and the boys tucked the guns and rode up the river road for to try to catch that young man and kill him before he can get across the river and wed Miss Sophia. I reckon they's going to be mighty rough times." Buck went off without waking me up. "Well, I reckon he did. They weren't going to mix you up in it. Marse Buck, he loaded up his gun, and Lord, he's going to fetch home a Shepherdson or bust. Well, there'll be plenty of them there, I reckon, and you bet he'll fetch one if he gets a chance." I took up the river road as hard as I could put. By and by, I begun to hear guns a good ways off. When I come in sight of the log store and the woodpile where the steamboat lands, I worked along under the trees and brush till I got to a good place, and then I clumb up into the forks of a cottonwood that was out of reach, and watched. There was a wood rank 4 feet high a little ways in front of the tree, and first I was going to hide behind that. But maybe it was luckier that I didn't. There was 4 or 5 men cavorting around on their horses in the open place before the log store, cussing and yelling, and trying to get at a couple of young chaps that was behind the wood rank alongside of the steamboat landing. But they couldn't come it. Every time one of them showed himself on the riverside of the woodpile, he got shot at. The 2 boys were squatting back to back behind the pile so they could watch both ways. By and by, the men stopped cavorting around and yelling. They started riding towards the store. Then up gets one of the boys, draws a steady bead over the wood rank, and drops one of them out of his saddle. All the men jumped off their horses and grabbed the hurt one and started to carry him to the store. And that minute, the 2 boys started on the run. They got halfway to the tree I was in before the men noticed. Then the men seen them and jumped on their horses and took out after them. They gained on the boys, but it didn't do no good. The boys had too good a start. They got to the woodpile that was in front of my tree and slipped in behind it, so they had the bulge on the men again. One of the boys was Buck, and the other was a slim young chap about 19 years old. The men ripped around a while and then rode away. As soon as they was out of sight, I sung out to Buck and told him. He didn't know what to make of my voice coming out of the tree at first. He was awful surprised. He told me to watch out sharp and let him know when the men come in sight again, and said they was up to some devilment or other. Wouldn't be gone long. I wished I was out of that tree, but I dasn't come down. Buck begun to cry and rip, and lowed that him and his cousin Joe, that was the other young chap, would make up for this day yet. He said his father and his 2 brothers was killed, and 2 or 3 of the enemy. Said the shepherds had laid for them in ambush. Buck said his father and brothers ought to have waited for their relations. The Shepherdsons was too strong for them. I asked him what was to become of young Harney and Miss Sophia. He said they'd got across the river and was safe. I was glad of that, but the way Buck did take on because he didn't manage to kill Harney that day he shot at him, I ain't never heard of anything like it. All of a sudden, bang, 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 goes 3 or 4 guns. The men had slipped around to the woods and come in from behind without their horses. The boys jumped for the river, both of them hurt, and as they swum down the current, the men run along the bank, shooting at them and singing out, "Kill 'em! Kill 'em!" It made me so sick, I almost fell out of the tree. I wasn't a-gonna tell all that happened. It would make me sick again if I was to do that. I wished I hadn't ever come ashore that night to see such things. I ain't ever gonna get shut of them. Lots of times I'd dream about them. I stayed in the tree till it begun to get dark, afraid to come down. Sometimes I heard guns away off in the woods, and twice I seen little gangs of men gallop past the log store with guns. So I reckon the trouble was still going on. I was mighty downhearted, so I made up my mind I wouldn't ever go near that house again, because I reckoned I was to blame somehow. I judged that that piece of paper meant that Miss Sophia was to meet Harney somewheres at 2:30 and run off, and I judged I ought to have told her father about that paper and the curious way she acted, and then maybe he would have locked her up, and this whole awful mess would never happen. When I got down out of the tree, I crept along down the riverbank a piece, and found the 2 bodies laying in the edge of the water, and I tugged at them till I got them ashore. Then I covered up their faces and got away as quick as I could. I cried a little when I was covering up Buck's face, for he was mighty good to me. It was just dark now. I never went near the house, but struck through the woods and made for the swamp. Jim weren't on his island, so I tramped off in a hurry for the creek and crowded through the willows, red hot to jump aboard and get out of that awful country. But the raft was gone. My souls, but I was scared. I couldn't get my breath for most of a minute. Then I raised a yell. A voice not 25 feet from me says, "Good land, is that you, honey? Don't make no noise." It was Jim's voice. Nothing ever sounded so good before. I run along the bank a piece and got aboard and Jim, he grabbed me and hugged me. He was so glad to see me. He says, "Laws bless you, child. I was right down shaw you did again. Jack's been here. He said he reckoned you's been shot, 'cause you didn't come home no more. So I just this minute of starting the raft down towards the mouth of the crick, so as to be all ready for to shove out and leave soon as Jack comes again and tells me for certain that you's dead. Lawsy, I's mighty glad to get you back again." I says, "All right, that's mighty good. They won't find me, and they'll think I've been killed and floated down the river. There's something up there that'll help them think so. So don't you lose no time, Jim, but just shove off for the big water as fast as you can." I never felt easy till the raft was 2 miles below there and out in the middle of the Mississippi. Then we hung up our signal lantern and judged that we was free and safe once more. I hadn't had a bite to eat since yesterday, so Jim, he got out some corn dodgers and buttermilk and pork and cabbage and greens. Ah, there ain't nothing in the world so good when it's cooked right. And whilst I ate my supper, we talked and had a good time. I was powerful glad to get away from the feuds, and so was Jim to get away from the swamp. We said there weren't no home like a raft, after all. All places do seem so cramped up and smothery, but a raft don't. You feel mighty free and easy and comfortable on a raft. Thanks for joining us for Chapter 17 and 18 of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. Stay tuned for the next installment next week Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks so much for joining us, everyone, and please do take a moment to send a review. Thanks for joining us.